from Relay FM. This is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of streaming media. This is episode number 64, recorded March the 5th, 2023. I'm your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and with me, as always, our director of strategy, Julia Alexander. Julia, where in the world are you right now?
I'm in St. Petersburg, Florida, as our listeners can tell from the sound quality, I'm sure, of my headphones.
I'm sure. So it's going to be a Travel and Julia episode, but you know what? The content is great and that's what matters.
You know, I think we can just treat this, Jason, as whenever they hear, cause you always sound fantastic, but whenever they hear me sounding like poop, they can just be aware in the world is Carmen San Diego moment.
That's right.
And that's, we can have that as a bit. It's a bit.
And it's Florida is the answer. You're in Florida and not the magical part, the other part.
No.
All right. So say hi to the Buccaneers, the Rays. All right. First topic on this episode, I wanted to talk about future of Netflix film. So Dan Lin named the new head of Netflix film. You know, we have seen a changing of the guard at Netflix in terms of the content. Previous head of Netflix film, the charter was very much volume. And it seems like Netflix's film strategy is changing. What do you think? Where do you think that they're going with their film strategy in terms of like how many releases and how many big budget versus, you know, how many of those Zack Snyder blockbusters versus those $20 million romantic comedies? What's the balance going to be like?
Yeah. So for people who don't know Dan Lin, not a household name, but a very big name in Hollywood, Dan Lin has made a lot of household or produced a lot of household films under his Rideback Productions company banner. So he's produced the Sherlock Holmes movies with Robert Downey Jr. He's produced It, which is the Pennywise movie, of course, for Warner Brothers. He's produced a lot of these kind of big films. The major film that he did for Netflix was The Two Popes, which was nominated for an Oscar a few years ago. So that's one of his bigger auteur films. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of the equation, he also just did Avatar: The Last Airbender, the live action adaptation, which has become one of Netflix's biggest debuts across all of its countries in the first weekend. So he's got this relationship with Netflix. He also has this relationship with other production houses. He came up via Warner Brothers, if I remember correctly, on movies like The Departed. Here's what Dan Lin signifies to me, right? And this is happening, we should mention, at the same time that Sean Bailey, who is the longtime studio executive over at Disney Live Action, has stepped away from the company. A lot of people thought he might be going to Netflix, and instead he's not. I think actually he'd be a great addition to A24 with Peter Rice, but that's for a different podcast. Mm. And so what Dan Lin, I think, really signifies to Netflix is threefold. I think one, you have someone who can make globally appealing family films. So you have somebody who's really going to create these multi-generational touchpoint arcs. That's really important when you're acquiring and establishing new IP. He's proven that he can create new IP. He's proven that he can work really well with an established IP and bring that forward to a new generation. So that's going to be really important for Netflix, especially as they reduce the quantity of films that they put out and really try to focus on quality. There's a few reasons why this is happening. One, Netflix's film strategy just has not worked as well as its TV strategy. This has been true since the dawn of Netflix film. Film's a very difficult business. It's a difficult business from a profitability standpoint, especially when you remove theatricality and the windowing capabilities that we're seeing a lot of the other traditional studios go back to. It's difficult when you're producing a movie a week to produce anything of worth at the level that people then think of it as. So if we think of like the A24 versus Netflix thing, which is two completely different business plans, but you've got this idea of an A24 movie feels like it's exciting because there's this precedent of strong A24 branding, strong A24 curation, versus Netflix kind of feels like when you go to Walmart and there's a bargain bin and you put your hand in it and you're like, whatever, I'll watch this and I'll completely forget about it. As I said to a friend, Netflix makes movies that are watched by a lot of people but are not popular.
I was going to say, and so is it wrong for me to think that Netflix is sort of like all movie studios all wrapped together, or at least has been, where, because it's literally, it's releasing big budget blockbusters. It's releasing in stuff it picks up at Sundance. It's releasing in like little mid-budget romantic comedies and things like that. It's got it's releasing some prestige stuff, and then it's releasing stuff that is just one notch above what we used to call a movie of the week, a TV movie, which is like cheap, and it puts something on the on the channel, or in this case, on the streaming service. So, like, there, at least under Scott Stuber, I think, Dan Lin is replacing him, it felt like Netflix's strategy was do everything.
Yeah.
And is their new strategy still do everything but less?
I think that's a really great summary, by the way. Like, that really does sum it up. And I think that speaks to the throw the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks strategy that Netflix has really been chasing. And I think what they wanted in Scott Stuber was somebody who could bring in auteurs. So Scott Stuber brought in Martin Scorsese with The Irishman. Like Scott Stuber has done a lot. He's also produced or he's overseen a lot of, again, for Netflix, big but not necessarily popular films. Red Notice is one of the. Is it Red Notice? Yeah, Red Notice is one of them. Right. Don't Look Up is another one,
sure.
From
Got Adam Oscar K. nominations. And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so I think what they want Dan Lin to do is actually create new IP or take established IP like he's done with Avatar and really show and that it can work. Yeah, especially when you think about the fact that they are now a cross-medium company. So they're thinking about games. They're thinking about where advertisers want to be on. Right. They're thinking about immersive experiences and live experiences. And so they're looking at Stranger Things and Avatar and some of these films, and they're like, or some of these titles, and they're thinking, how can we do this on the film side? And Dan Lin has established himself there. Two, really important for Dan Lin, which he wants to do, he has proven he can do, and is now going to be important to Netflix, international films. Now, this is twofold. This is both figuring out which territories film is a strong subscriber acquisition and engager in, and figuring out if you need to create local film within those markets or acquire local film to continue doing so, as well as figuring out what type of films are really going to travel well. So we talk about Rebel Moon a lot in this podcast, probably more than Jason and I should.
Or than anybody else did, honestly, but we did.
Yeah, we did. And this idea that that type of movie clearly did not work. It didn't work from a numbers perspective. It didn't generate the numbers Netflix was hoping for, from what I can tell. But the other thing about that movie is that it feels like it can travel well. Something I hear quite a bit as a theory from people who not inside Netflix, from people who are outside of Netflix but cover it as analysts, is that as they pursue more international film, big action movies require less dialogue. So it travels better, right? Because the cultural touch point is like fighting, which and big explosions,
visuals,
which we all
sound.
Love.
Yeah.
Exactly. Versus comedies and dramas tend to be much more culturally significant to the territory. And so it's like, okay, well, how do you parlay that kind of specific culture without acquiring local content? So Dan Lin's going to figure out in territories, again, where film is still a strong acquisition tool as well as an engagement tool. Do we have to go local, or can we do a big Sherlock Holmes? And we know that a lot of international territories still love A-list stars. And so Dan Lin has proven that he can do big IP with A-list stars. But here's the third thing I think he has to do. I'm curious in your opinion on this. I think what Netflix needs to do is almost separate as it figures out its brand. And brand is going to be increasingly important to a platform like Netflix, just as it is to Disney. Because as we have AI video become, and this is going to take years, but as AI video becomes really, really much more advanced, it's not necessarily going to affect Disney and Netflix, but it will affect YouTube, Instagram, TikTok. And so people who are going to get some idea of entertainment that they can get for free, it's going to increase on those platforms. And so people will feel like, okay, I'm getting a better experience on YouTube, but it is still a specific experience. The value associated with it is free versus Netflix, Disney, Warner. These are still premium experiences. So the idea is not to lean into more quantity where you're degrading your quality. And all of a sudden it's like, well, this is just as good as that, but I'm paying for it. It's to increase the quality, increase the casting, increase the ability to say we're creating something really special that AI is not going to touch and creates a differentiated product. And so the third thing I think that Dan Lin needs to do is almost create what would have been a Searchlight or a Focus or a United Artists within Netflix. And you can actually have it be really differentiated in terms of what customers can expect. These are typically your Oscar hopefuls, so but that also means that they typically go to theaters. And so you can say, like, this is our theatrical arm. You can work with artists who say, like, I don't necessarily want to be in a Netflix movie because what does that mean? You know, like, I get a payday, sure, but I really want to be proud of what I'm doing. I want to be part of this great arm. Like, that's why they go to A24. And Dan Lin wants to work with auteurs. He wants to bring them up. Create a subdivision within Netflix film that is like Netflix Searchlight, effectively. You can have the name be in there. And then let that be an arm on its own to generate this ability of, like, that is a branded moment that when that comes out, I'm really excited. I might go to theaters for it, but the minute it's on, I'm going to watch it. You're going to have less views than your popcorn flicks are going to do, because these types of films generate less audience attention than big popcorn flicks does. But I think Dan Lin can separate it and say, we're going to bring the auteurs here. We're going to bring them into the Netflix fold. We're going to find a way for them to do their indie movie as well as give them the ability to take on big IP. But we're really going to harness that talent in a way that Disney has. And I think that's going to be crucial to really separating that value proposition from Netflix.
Yeah, I you talk about branding. I was going to say, I love how a disruptive company like Netflix can break a lot of rules. And by breaking the rules, learn things about and advance over its competition. However, I am reminded of how sometimes some of the rules and some of the methods made sense and even make sense today. And so when you talk about branding, you talk about a theatrical arm, and Netflix is like, no, no movie theaters, right? We don't want to do that. And yet maybe there's some validity in that. I was also thinking like the structure of, I'm going to bring us back to TV, old TV, and like movies of the week and things like that, is there is structure and there is regularity, and that and there's also in the branding of it, there's a, you know what a Lifetime movie is. I think when we look at Netflix, one of the problems that Netflix has is it's all undifferentiated. There's so much of it. And even if they are releasing fewer movies, there's still so much content on Netflix, and they are trying to be everything, doing every kind of movie. Maybe you need some structure and some branding, even if it is only customer side, you know, only for the receivers of it. But like to say, we are going to do a little sidebar, we talk about new intellectual property, you mentioned it, and we've talked a lot about branding challenges at Netflix and trying to create franchises and not succeeding. One franchise is a series of standalones that fit a model, that fit a point of view, right? So saying we're going to do a movie every 3 weeks or every month or every 2 weeks or whatever, and it's going to be relatively low budget, and it's going to be, you know, for lack of a better term, it's going to be romantic comedies. It's going to fit this kind of like Hallmark-ish vibe or whatever you want to say it, whatever it is. And not just sort of like do that internally, but like make a name for it, market it, put all of those movies in a strip on the Netflix app, make people feel like they can, let them subscribe to it so that it shows up when there's a new one and they get a notification. Because then people are like, I like that kind of thing. Here's another kind of thing. And the algorithm can do some of that. But if you're rolling out originals, there's strength in saying every other Friday, this kind of movie is going to happen, or once a month, this kind of movie is going to happen. And it's got and you're creating branding that belongs to Netflix and that anything could slot into. And I think I know that the algorithm is powerful and you can just tag everything as everything else. But like, I don't know, having a schedule, having regularity, having a little bit of a brand promise, I think these are things that Netflix could use to its benefit instead of it being like, we got a big bowl of movies, come find a movie. Well,
That's exactly it. And the thing that I kind of harp on a lot whenever I talk about Netflix is this idea that networks have disappeared into these all-encompassing streaming services. Right. So like networks are gone, but it's like, they're not. You're actually just creating network-style television or to your point, like these movie of the weeks, these specific type of branded films, but you're putting it all under one banner. And at some point, the idea of what a Netflix original is gets lost. The idea of what a Netflix original was The idea of what a Netflix original was circa 2015 could be something because you only had so many original titles. So the idea of a Netflix original was still relatively new. But think about the idea of Disney or Warner Brothers putting everything under a Warner Brothers banner, including HBO content, right? Or think about Disney, including instead of Star Wars or Marvel, it's now just this is a Disney film. And you're like, no, that's a Marvel film, that's an HBO show. And those brands belong to these larger conglomerates, but they mean something. And those audiences really cling to brand. And I think as we go forward, when there is just this surplus of content and information for people to just dive into, the only things that stick out are for these larger companies are quality, brand, connection to talent or personality. This ability to say we have all three of these things and that's what makes us valuable is so key. I think there was a really great interview between Ben Thompson, who we talk about a lot in this podcast, we both love him, and Matt Bellany over at Puck on his podcast, The Town. And Ben Thompson says, like, the biggest issue that these entertainment companies have is that they're chasing tech profit margins. And, like, you're not going to get there. And it's because Netflix kind of hit that. And Netflix was like, well, it's a tech company. And so everyone was like, well, now if we're going to be D2C, we're going to be a tech company. But in doing so, they chase all of these kind of advances that don't necessarily advance the quality of the content. And at the end of the day, that's what you are. People go to Disney World not because they love like Disney Plus. They go because they love Captain America. And so they want to go hang out with Darth Vader and Captain America. And I think there's this element within Netflix of everything's an original now. But that means that you are diluting the quality of your really strong quality programming with this just abundance of programming that you feel like you have to have. And I think what we'll see with Dan Lim, to Jason's point, really important point from Jason, it's not that rom-coms are going to disappear, right? It's not like all of a sudden Netflix is only going to do Sherlock Holmes. But it's this idea of, okay, if we're going to spend $250 million on a movie, what does this movie really look like? How can we ensure the quality as opposed to just being like, we're going to give Zack Snyder room to do what he's going to do, and we're going to do a 6-hour, I read somewhere, like a 6-hour extended version. What does that mean to Netflix's brand? It doesn't really mean anything. In fact, it kind of, again, dilutes that brand. It's kind of like, well, this is what I think of when I think of a Netflix original film. So with Dan Lin coming in, being able to segment this into like brands or studios and networks again and say like, this is that, like this is a popcorn flick. Half of it's going to work, half of it's not. That's been true since the dawn of film. Like we just, half it's going to go well and half it's not. But we're also going to have this arm that we really feel passionate about, that we know is going to have less viewership in general, but we know that's going to stick out to people, the right people within Hollywood. So that way we can continue making this type of elevated film that is going to separate us, again, from the consumer platforms as they become slightly better. Again, not, AI is not going to create the next Godfather. But as those platforms become slightly better with the creators who are garnering attention, the only differentiator is quality, brand, and attachment of personality or talent. And I think Netflix risks, without doing this, the ability of losing a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, so lots for Dan Lin to think about and lots for Dan Lin to do and to strategize with the rest of the team there, including, you know, all the way up to the CEO, but like there's a real group there. They've got their original TV. He's doing the original movies. There's all sorts of strategizing for them to do. They're in a great position, but you know, we're here. We're not here saying Netflix is doing it all wrong. We're here saying they've got some interesting challenges. And I find it, and I think you do too, because we keep talking about it. I find it interesting to probe all of the parts of Netflix's business that seem, I wouldn't even say weak, but seem like they're getting by on Netflix's power when they could maybe be better. But because Netflix is going so great right now, it almost doesn't matter. But in the long run, wouldn't you want those to be better too?
Like, can I point out something here that I think, Jason, because I think you just hit the nail on the head. Like, I think that's exactly it. And it is this chicken versus egg situation that Hollywood has. A great example is there was a lot of press, I think last week, so we didn't cover it the week before. So I think it was last week. And it was, we finally got the Nielsen numbers for Killers of the Flower Moon on Apple TV Plus. And it only generated it was like 5 million hours or something. It wasn't a lot. And it was this question. Everyone was like, well, look how bad this movie is performing for Apple. And I had this immediate question of like, would this movie have naturally done better on Netflix because Netflix has the subscriber numbers? And so therefore we would have thought, well, it really performed on Netflix or it generated a larger, because that audience is there. And for Apple, the question is then, okay, well, how many of those numbers were new customers, right? Like it's still small enough that the acquisition part of that title is really key. Like if that was all new subscribers, and I doubt that it was, but if it was all new subscribers, that would be more substantial than strong engagement for that title on Netflix. And I think what you're saying is it really leans into that. This idea of like, we give Netflix a lot of leeway because Netflix has the size. And so therefore they can accomplish things. Same with YouTube, right? Like YouTube gets all, because they have the size of the audience. And so they have a relatively easier time, not easy. We definitely have a hard job, but easier time of saying this is going to travel well, to the point that Ted Sarandos has said this, like the reason that they bring licensed content over is because they have the audience to then rejuvenate that kind of, those kind of titles that we saw with Suits. But the idea then of, okay, well, Netflix gets a win because the audience size is not going to last forever, especially as, I mean, I think Netflix still has pricing power. Their churn rate is at end of 2023 was like less than 2.5%, which is incredible. So they still have pricing power. They can still increase prices without seeing huge churn. But at some point, there is going to be a more competitive sphere. And while Netflix has that advantage now, as Disney reaches 60, 70 million subscribers with the Hulu integration, as we see some more consolidation or merging maybe between Paramount and Peacock, whatever it might be, that obvious win gets a little bit narrower. And I think that's where the branding becomes really important.
Yeah. I mean, I nobody at Netflix wants to hear me say this, but the way to view it is in part, okay, you're going great right now, but what happens when you're not? Like that's, you can see that with that, right, that moment where things kind of fall apart and you start looking around, and one of the things that, and they did have that moment a while ago. And I think that's one of the reasons that they keep shifting their film strategy, but it's like, it's worth looking at it now because it's an important part of your business. And now you've got the leeway to sort of experiment and find the right answer, but it does feel like a part of their business that's kind of like all over the place. Yeah. All right, let's move on to letters. You can email us. Downstreamfeedback.com is the best place. Don't send us an email because they're spam. Downstreamfeedback.com. We would love to hear from you. Let's do some letters real quick before we go. Mike wrote in to say what we should say when we're talking last week. We talked about bundles a lot. Is let's get ready to bundle. Thank you, Mike. Just that made me laugh. Got an anonymous email who said there are two ends to the bundle. Rights are so valuable, there isn't one place where you can get everything from a given league, so we can't find a one-stop shop for our favorite league, whether it's the NFL, MLB, NBA, whatever, except for more niche sports like MLS or Formula One. The flip side is there isn't a way to pay for only games from the NFL, MLB, or NBA. Does the latter flow inevitably from the former? Does the value of these leagues mean they will always be bundled with other unrelated content?
Yeah. The issue here, so I mean, there are leagues that, okay, so give some examples. There are leagues that really find immense value in owning a form of direct consumer relationship. So MLB, NBA are two of the biggest ones. Like, they have their own form of that. The issue more so is twofold. It's that the leagues know they're not going to make the amount of money they need to make, and especially when you think of players' unions, or think of, and also just profit, because it's capitalism. Like, they need to work with all of these different media partners. That's why you have a lot of these leagues seeking out fourth partners, fifth partners, yeah, for the first time with the tech guys. They need to increase the level of money they're making. They're not going to do that on the direct consumer way. Like, the way that they organize a lot of these rights conversations, it's like, here's how much advertising it's going to bring in based on the audience. They know this. So what they do is go like, well, we have to work with the partners. Also, the partners extend the amount of audience, right? So it keeps building up a larger audience theoretically. So that way the leagues have a stronger longevity. So they can't go buy themselves direct to consumer. Then there's the whole local rights. But what I will say is, on the other end of it, they do have to partner it with some form of additional bundling entertainment in some capacity, because that's how they help pay for it. Like, you know what I mean? It's one of those things where both sides are trying, yeah, to figure out how to support the cost of sports rights. And I don't see a world, even if linear TV went away tomorrow, I don't see a world in which the leagues go like, we're going to bring it out in ourselves, because they lose that casual audience immediately.
Exactly.
And they also don't generate enough to offset the cost.
I think that's it, is that in the long run, we're probably going to see two different approaches to sports rights, because they're going to be leagues where splitting up the rights and having you spend a lot more money than maybe it would be worth direct to consumer is worth it for the rights holder, or for the, you know, for the network, because, and this is the NFL essentially, it's so popular that you will overpay because you need to be a part of it, and then you need to use that to promote your other product. And like, that's a good business to be in. But you're right too. The other way that this goes is just, look, we're going to have multiple partners because we need to be seen by people who are general subscribers, right? It's the, how do you pick up a casual fan? And the answer is, well, a casual NBA fan will just be flipping by TNT or ESPN or wherever and see a game and be like, oh, there's a game on, or I'm just here for the playoffs or whatever. And there's value in selling postseason rights and some in-season rights. ESPN Sunday Night Baseball, like, oh, I don't really watch that much baseball, but Sunday night there's a baseball game on and I'll watch that sometimes. There's value in that for the league and for the bundled up service. Yeah. But those leagues probably have a direct-to-consumer play as well, right? Where it's literally just, or you can just buy all of Major League Baseball. You can already do that except for the in-market teams. And so I feel like most leagues will probably be that mix, which is, look, if you're a hardcore fan, you can pay the price, whatever it is, $200 a year or whatever, for a direct-to-consumer product that gets you everything. But you still want to have, like, even Apple, which owns all of MLS, puts games on linear, because they want, and their partner, the MLS, the league, wants visibility. And it's incremental revenue too, but it's also visibility for their product. And to me, that feels like the long the long run solution to this issue is there'll be some singular product that hardcore fans can buy, but you still are going to want to be elsewhere, with the only exception potentially being something like the NFL, which has a national contract and is so in demand. It's literally, there was a stat, Julia, that like 90 of the 100 highest rated broadcast TV shows last year in the US were NFL. And then like eight of the rest were college football. And then it was like it was
97% were football. So, and it was like, and it was up from like 93, and like the other ones were like a State of the Union. Like
it was the Oscars, and it was literally that was it. So football in America is different and will probably be treated differently. But like, I think if you're the NHL or the NBA or Major League Baseball, your model's going to be more like MLS, where you're going to have a hardcore thing, and then you're also going to put stuff on other platforms as a taster, you know, as some for, to reach casual fans, I think. Does that sound right? I'm doing the Julia.
I think that sounds
check
right.
Now. But football, I think that sounds like, right. For our listeners outside of the U.S., you don't understand. I hope that stat gave it to you. Like NFL and really college football, which is rapidly becoming another professional league, very rapidly, like just in the last few months. Yeah. Those dominate. Those dominate. And that's a different argument. Strategically, even, because you kind of want to be part of the party there.
Football is the only last monoculture in the United States.
Yeah, it really
is. It's the last one.
It really is. And that's why you keep seeing entertainment companies do these, like Fox and, is it Fox and Disney? There's a joint venture that's essentially doing the USFL, the XFL. What is it now? It's the UFL, I guess. They merged them together. It's a spring football league. And literally, it's like we are so desperate for football content in the one part of the year where it doesn't exist that the TV companies are making a league just to get more football on. It's amazing.
I had a friend who was very funny. One of my friends, she was like, I was complaining that football was over, and I'm like, I don't know what to do with my life. And she was like, why don't they just make football longer? And I very like quietly was like, my friend, the amount of head injuries.
The players can't. They have made it
they
longer.
They can't do it.
And it's brutal.
They made it 1 week longer, and all of us were like, oh, man.
Then some bye weeks. They might add more bye weeks. Who knows? All right. We have reached the end. If you have a question for us, downstreamfeedback.com. Love to your mothers. If you are not a Downstream Plus subscriber, you missed us talking about Harry Potter updates and the very interesting intersection between business and creative that's going on at HBO Max and WBD. We talked about the CW a little bit and how that might be a future model. There's a lot of stuff that we talked about that you missed, but that's okay. That's because every other episode, most of the show is available for our supporters. If you'd like to be one, downstream.plus. Plus, you'll get full versions of every episode, access to the Relay FM Discord, bonus shows, and more. Until next time, you can find Director of Strategy Julia at ParrotAnalytics.com and, of course, Puck.News, which is super excellent and getting better all the time. You should subscribe. I'm so happy to be a subscriber. You can find me at SixColors.com and at many other podcasts here at Relay FM, including Upgrade, which you should check out because that's a real good one. And that brings us to the end. Until next time, who knows where Julia will be? Maybe home. Bye, Julia.
Bye, everyone.